Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Vitamin D is in the news a lot recently, especially associated with increased risks of cancer and illnesses like diabetes and multiple sclerosis. Why might that be? And do Americans get enough vitamin D, particularly those of us living at high latitudes? Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage, and outside of Anchorage, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking with vitamin D authority Dr. Michael Hollick on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Providence Imaging Center, providing Alaska women complete breast imaging services since 1986, including radiologists who specialize in breast imaging 5 days a week. Information online at provimaging.com.
And by
the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is vitamin D. Our phone numbers in Anchorage are familiar to you, as if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, the numbers are 550-8422, and our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us during the program at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. My guest today is Dr. Michael Hollick. He's a national authority on vitamin D. He's joining us by telephone from Boston, and he's also professor of medicine at Boston University College of Medicine. Before I get started, I want to just take a brief moment to remind our listeners that next week we'll be talking with Brian Dunning. Brian is a skeptic and a podcast producer who's known for his critical thinking, particularly about pop phenomenon, and we'll be analyzing misconceptions and poor reasoning regarding healthcare issues such as vaccine ingredients and electromagnetic radiation. Dr. Hollick, welcome to Line 1.
Thanks, Ted. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's really wonderful to have someone of your knowledge about vitamin D taking the time to speak with us. So let's get right into it. What's a vitamin?
Well, a vitamin by definition means that your body can't make it and that you need to get it from the diet. And that's why vitamin D is really kind of a misnomer, because vitamin D is made in your skin. And as a result, just by that definition alone, it's a hormone more than a vitamin.
Mm. And so distinguish between hormones and vitamins. So and I guess the obvious question is it misnamed? Are we actually misclassifying this product anyway?
Well, typically a hormone means that you make it in one place and it travels through the body, usually in the bloodstream, to another place to carry out its biologic function. A good example would be, say, estrogen made in the ovaries, right? And then it travels to the uterus to have effects on the uterus, so it's considered to be a hormone. So when you're exposed to sunlight, you make vitamin D in your skin. And so you don't have to get it from dietary sources. Your own body makes it. So by definition, the vitamin D is truly hormone vitamin D.
Okay. All right. So you've mentioned sunlight as a vitamin, and I think most of us listening would think, well, okay, but what about food? What are the other sources of vitamin D?
Yeah, that's the problem. Most people thought that if you have an adequate diet, a healthy diet, that you're getting all the nutrient value that you need. And it turns out that vitamin D is essentially one of the rarest vitamins available in foods. So typically it's found in fortified food like milk and yogurt. Some orange juices are fortified with vitamin D. Salmon, wild-caught salmon, is a good source. Mushrooms actually turn out to be a good source, especially if they're irradiated or sun-dried. Those are the major sources. And, of course, cod liver oil.
I'm expecting a big resurgence in cod liver oil.
There you go. The problem, though, is that just like if you're vitamin D deficient, you can't simply take a bunch of multivitamins that contain vitamin D because you're going to get too much vitamin A. The same problem is with cod liver oil. Not only is there vitamin D in cod liver oil, there's vitamin A. So you can only take one dose of cod liver oil, which is probably all the people can take anyway. But you would get too much vitamin A, so you can't take too much.
So there'd be a toxicity to obtain enough vitamin D to really be helpful, you're saying, I guess.
Yeah, well, you'd get too much vitamin A.
Vitamin A, right.
Increase risk of osteoporosis and birth defects.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, you know, I guess the other thought is let's examine the amount of vitamin D in milk. Why is there vitamin D in milk? What has that done, and why is it not sufficient?
Right. So it turns out that this was discovered back in the 1920s at the University of Wisconsin, and it was realized that if you can expose people and animals to sunlight and it prevented rickets, why not irradiate or expose food like milk to sunlight or simulated sunlight? And that process alone eradicated rickets. What people don't realize, 100 years ago in Boston, New York City, Chicago, more than 80% of children had bone-deforming disease rickets, which caused growth retardation and serious deformities, especially of the lower legs.
Hmm. So what happened then? There was a big public, and one of the great public health benefits then was this addition of vitamin D to food products, which is a virtually eradicated rickets with a very small amount, but it is not enough, it's felt now, to give us sufficient vitamin D for health. Is that also
fair? That's correct. In other words, rickets is really kind of the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
You know, it's the most overt manifestation of vitamin D deficiency, but there are much more subtle and important consequences of vitamin D deficiency, and I'll give you one example. They did a study in Finland where they were giving children during their first year of life 2,000 units of vitamin D a day. And they followed them for 31 years, and they found a reduced risk of getting type 1 diabetes by 78%. Those children that were vitamin D deficient during their first year of life had a 2.4-fold increased risk of getting type 1 diabetes. So just there, in and of itself, we now recognize that 100 units in a glass of milk or orange juice or 100 or 400 units even in a multivitamin no longer is probably adequate to satisfy both children and adults' vitamin D requirement for all the health benefits.
Well, let's flesh out a little bit more of what the important actions are besides bone health, which we've alluded to. What else do we know about vitamin D?
Sure. Well, first of all, I need to explain to your audience that when you make vitamin D in your skin, it has no activity in the body.
Okay.
And it requires an activation in the liver to 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And the reason for mentioning this is that this is the form of vitamin D that you would ask your doctor to obtain to determine your vitamin D status.
Right.
And then it goes to your kidneys, where it gets finally activated to its active form, which then goes to the intestine and bone to regulate your calcium metabolism for bone health. But we also now recognize that the vitamin D, the circulating form, actually can go to the colon and prostate and breast and heart and get activated locally. And we believe that by doing so, that it can regulate cell growth, it can regulate heart function, it can regulate insulin production in the kidneys, so it has all of these other biologic activities. And we're now appreciating that in total, having enough vitamin D on board can markedly improve your health, reduce risk of common cancers by as much as 50%, reduce risk of type 2 diabetes 33%, reduce risk of your first heart attack by 50%, reduce risk of multiple sclerosis in women by 42%, and the list goes on.
Let me remind our listeners very quickly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Michael Hollick. We're talking about vitamin D, particularly consequences of vitamin D insufficiency, and how you can get appropriate amounts and measure it, and what good that was really going to do for you from a health standpoint. If you've got questions, you can call us here in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. And we have a toll-free number, 1-800-478-8222. 5-5. Well, what are the, you said if we go to the doctor, we're going to ask for a level to see what our level is. We would be measuring the hydroxyvitamin D level. So what is a normal level? What's expected? What is the normal level? And then while we're talking, perhaps you could mention that I don't believe the new guidelines or recommendations from the Institute of Medicine report are out yet. Perhaps you might give us some ideas about how things might be changing in that area.
Sure. So the blood level of 25 hydroxyvitamin D should be above 30 nanograms per ml. That's where most experts, including myself, believe everybody should be to get the full health benefits of vitamin D, and up to 100 is perfectly safe. The Institute of Medicine is now meeting, and I believe that they will substantially increase the recommendation for intake. I mean, even now, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that all infants and all children be on 400 units of vitamin D a day. The Institute of Medicine's recommendation right now is 200 units a day for children and adults alike. Mm-hmm. And we now recognize that probably even 400 is not adequate, and that probably 1,000 units of vitamin D a day is better. Another major and important message that hopefully will be coming from the Institute of Medicine is not how much that we recommend to people, but how much they recommend is the safe upper limit for vitamin D, because that limits the amount of vitamin D that food manufacturers can put into their food products. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why there's only 100 international units, say, in a glass of milk. That prevents rickets in children, but you need probably at least 1,000, if not 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, if you're not exposed to a reasonable amount of sunlight, in order to satisfy your body's vitamin D requirement.
And my understanding, and again, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, that up to, even in children, 2,000 international units have been shown to be pretty safe.
Correct. Like I said, there was that study in Finland where they were giving 2,000 units of vitamin D a day to infants during their first year of life. A study done in Lebanon where they gave young girls 9 to 18 years of age 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, improved their bone health, and improved muscle function. And we're now recognizing that vitamin D is critically important for muscle function. For the elderly, it helps prevent them from falling and therefore fracturing. And for the young, it actually improves their stamina.
For those of you who are listening also and want to get more information, if you go to our website, you'll have a link to Dr. Hollick's website where he has a great amount of information, including a video to help you understand more about vitamin D. And I want to mention that he has a new book coming out, certainly The Vitamin D Solution, that when's it going to be published, you said, shortly?
April 1st.
April 1st. But the website is excellent. He has a review there that anyone can read. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, one of our foremost journals for healthcare providers. A couple of questions have already come in. Let me get this. One, this is from someone who says, I have an adult family member who's a vegetarian, recently discovered his vitamin D level was 11, which is very low. Well, how much should he take to get this up this winter, and what level is optimum? We've already talked about it, but the issue is, how do you get it up if you're already low? And then another question along the same line was, his maintenance dose, should it be different than others because he's a vegetarian?
Excellent questions. So for vegetarians, sometimes they don't want to take vitamin D3 because it originates from lanolin, from sheep's wool. So vitamin D2, it turns out, is coming from yeast. It's the only pharmaceutical form of vitamin D available in the United States. It's approved by the FDA because it predated the FDA, and vitamin D3 was never approved. And so what I recommend, and we just published a paper in Archives of Internal Medicine, it just came out about 3 weeks ago, it's 50,000 units of vitamin D2 once a week for 8 weeks. And what you want to do basically is fill up the empty vitamin D tank. And that's equivalent to taking 6,000 units of vitamin D a day. And then to prevent vitamin D deficiency from reoccurring, I put them on 50,000 units of vitamin D every 2 weeks forever. And we now have up to 6 years of experience, and all of my patients have healthy blood levels of 25-hydroxyvitamin D, and there is no toxicity.
I I guess I was somewhat distracted. I want to make sure I understand. So when you are deficient, the 50,000 international units per week for 8 weeks, I'm well aware of, but then the additional every 2 weeks for what particular reason?
Forever.
Because they're a vegetarian?
No, for everyone.
For everyone.
Okay. The problem is that what often physicians don't realize is why did the patient come in vitamin D deficient? Because they weren't getting enough vitamin D.
Okay.
So the physicians are now treating vitamin D deficiency, and we were the ones that introduced this way of treating it that we published in Lancet in 1998. But they weren't then controlling the amount of vitamin D that the patient was taking thereafter. So now what I do is I put them on 50,000 units every 2 weeks, which is equivalent to taking 3,000 units of vitamin D a day.
So you're saying that even once you've bulked up your stores, you still need to continue to have the higher dose because they came in insufficient and they're saying their diet is not sufficient enough or whatever they're doing. We haven't talked about sunlight exposure.
Yeah, which we can get into. But we think now that probably everyone needs, all adults need, between 1,500 to 2,000 units a day minimum throughout the year. And we showed last year in the wintertime in Boston, healthy adults that got 1,000 units of vitamin D a day, essentially not one of them raised their blood level above 30. We know 1,000 units doesn't do it. And as a way of thinking about your vitamin D level and where you want to go, we know for every 100 units of vitamin D you ingest, you raise your blood level of 25-hydroxy vitamin D by 1 nanogram per ml. So if he's at 11, right, for him to get to 30, he would need to be taking a significant amount of vitamin D in order to get there.
Okay. And remind our listeners, 30 to 100 are the levels we're shooting for. A minimum of 30 up to 100 seems to be safe.
Exactly.
A couple more questions come from a different email. Does age enter into the equation as to how much vitamin D is needed, and does the target score change with age?
That's an excellent question, and it turns out that as people age, their requirement for vitamin D does not change, and that even though it was thought that maybe aging decreased your ability to absorb vitamin D, is not true. But what is true is that as you age, your ability to make vitamin D decreases. And so if you compare a 20-year-old compared to a 70-year-old, the 70-year-old can only make about 25% of the amount of vitamin D that a 20-year-old makes. But if they're out there, you know, with a reasonable amount of time exposing arms and legs, two or three times a week, it's still they have enough capacity to satisfy their vitamin D requirement. For children, we also recommend, at least I do, is that children over the year of one year of age, should be on 1,000 units of vitamin D a day. And teenagers probably on 2,000 units of vitamin D a day. And neonates, at least 400, plus whatever additional vitamin D may be coming from the infant formula or from human breast milk. And just to add, essentially there is no vitamin D in human breast milk because most moms are vitamin D deficient or insufficient. And so if you're breastfeeding and you're not taking at least 2,000, and it's now estimated 4 to 6,000 units a day, you're not putting enough vitamin D in your milk to satisfy your infant's requirement. And your infant definitely requires at least 400 units of vitamin D a day.
We have a number of questions, and before I get to those, I want to talk about that, these issues that you've brought up, and then I want to bring in the relationship to those of us who live in high latitudes and that relationship to other ways of getting vitamin D, such as sunlight. Since we've talked so much about the oral ingestion, is there ways to prevent the need from that insufficiency from developing with vitamin D, with sunlight, particularly in northern climates? So let's get to Anchorage and Alaska in particular here with these questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the indigenous people, you know, learned thousands of years ago, probably through trial and error, that if they ate a little bit of polar liver, and if they ate some seal blubber, and other oily fish, that is a superb source of vitamin D, and that's the reason why they probably never suffered from vitamin D deficiency. However, being so far north, you probably only can make vitamin D in your skin from about maybe 11 a.m. to about 2 or 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And you probably are only making probably about 25 to 50% of the amount that we would make in Boston at the same time of the year. And 6 months of the year, you're probably not making any vitamin D in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
All the more reason why I'm telling everyone now, you should always be on a vitamin D supplement, even in the summertime, and even if you're outside in the sun, because A, you'll remember to do it because it becomes a routine, and B, you can never make too much vitamin D from sun exposure, and so taking a little bit more as a supplement is probably healthy for you, and it won't harm you.
One of the questions we've gotten regarding toxic effects of too much vitamin D by ingesting foods high in vitamin D, maybe plus sunlight or extra vitamin D in vitamin forms. Is that likely to happen, and can it happen?
Excellent question. And it turns out that we and others have done studies, and we've shown that you can take up to 10,000 units of vitamin D a day and not worry about intoxication. You really need to be taking probably 30 to 50,000 units a day for at least a half a year before you even begin to worry. I had a case where a gentleman in Florida called me up and was really upset because he kind of was following my advice. And a decade ago, you couldn't get a vitamin D supplement in your local pharmacy. So he went on the internet, and he was taking a teaspoon twice a day of this vitamin preparation that was supposed to be 1,000 units in a teaspoon. The company forgot to dilute it. He was taking 1 million units a day. He was vitamin D intoxicated. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means that your blood calcium goes up. It can cause kidney failure. It can cause kidney stones. It can cause calcification of your blood vessels and ultimately death. But vitamin D intoxication is one of the rarest medical conditions in the world, and it really only occurs from inadvertent or intentional huge doses of vitamin D ingestion.
Those of us up in the Alaska are known for going to Mexico and Hawaii in the wintertime. Can we bulk up with sun exposure? How is it stored, if it's stored, and how long would that last?
That's an excellent question. It turns out that the major problem, of course, is that you've not had very much exposure to sunlight. And so if you're Caucasian and you're going down to Mexico, for example, and you're just baking out on the beach, you're going to get a significant sunburn. And we never encourage people to sunburn. And in fact, usually I recommend, even say in Mexico, probably 5 or 10 minutes maximum, arms and legs, abdomen, back, if you're in a bathing suit. You're probably making about 5,000 to 10,000 units of vitamin D. And yes, you will store a lot of that in your body fat. And in fact, evolution kind of dictated that as people migrated north and south of the equator, A, they lost their skin pigment in order to make enough vitamin D. And they also then, as they're making vitamin D, they stored it in their body fat and then released it in the wintertime. So we know that if you go for a week's vacation and you're building up your vitamin D store, it'll probably last you about 2 to 4 weeks more, but it will not last you through the winter.
Okay. I have a phone call we're going to take now. Vicki, you're on line one.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Woodard.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've sort of a complicated medical question. I'm a perimenopausal woman. I'm borderline osteoporotic. And I had gastric bypass, and I have sarcoidosis. So I do supplement with vitamin D. I take 2,000 units a day. And I'm just wondering, at what level should I be careful because of the issues with hypercalcemia that people who have sarcoidosis have? I'm really interested in hearing what your vitamin D expert feels about that, because I'm really concerned that I'm going to bump up against those toxic levels.
Yep.
Sooner than the average person.
Yep. Well, I'm not answering this one, so don't worry.
Oh, come on, guys.
No. Dr. Hollick is. This is out of my league.
Good. Yeah. Even my doctors won't touch it, and I see three different doctors for all of my various conditions, and they're like, "Oh, I'm not touching this either."
All righty.
So it's an excellent question. In fact, I have several patients just like you. And if you go to my website and get that New England Journal review, I actually give a prescription for how to deal with this. But long story short is that when you have bypass, sometimes you have a difficult time in absorbing vitamin D, which is why you may need to take more vitamin D. But right. on the other hand, like you said, what the sarcoid does, it activates vitamin D in an unregulated fashion that can cause your blood calcium to go up. But if you don't have any vitamin D, which is what often doctors do for patients with sarcoid, they wind up with vitamin D deficiency and a painful bone disease known as osteomalacia or adult rickets. So what I recommend is that you take enough vitamin D to maintain your blood level of 25-hydroxy vitamin D between about 25 and 30 nanograms per ml. If you go much above 30 nanograms per ml, that's when you can run into trouble.
Okay. That's really good to know. I'm just really concerned about my bone health at this age.
Sure. And you're absolutely sure. right. Because sure. a lot of physicians think that because you're making so much activated vitamin D, that it's okay to be vitamin D deficient. It is not. We see a lot of patients that get into a lot of trouble. And we haven't talked about this yet, but for the listeners and for you, I'm sure you're probably aware that if you're vitamin D deficient, often the symptoms are aches and pains in the bones and muscles. And often,
which is identical to sarcoidosis.
Exactly. And so people have throbbing, aching bone pain. And this is due to vitamin D deficiency.
Wow. So how would I know the difference between that and a exacerbation of my sarcoid? I'd have to have a blood
simple.
Test, right?
Yeah, well, it's simple, because if you maintain your blood level of 25-hydroxy-D between 25 and 30, and the symptoms don't resolve, it's likely due to your sarcoid. But if you maintain your blood levels in that range, you're not likely to be vitamin D deficient and have the bone disease osteomalacia.
Okay. Oh, that's really good to know. I really appreciate your help. We've kind of been flying blind with this and trying to figure out what's best for me. And my pulmonologist has one opinion, and my OBGYN has another opinion. And they're both, you know, just want to do what's right for me.
Of course.
Tell them
to go to my website.
Yeah, tell them to go.
All you do is pick up my New England Journal Review, and you could teach them.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, definitely. Just... Well, I'm a nurse, so I'm used to teaching doctors.
There you go. You
all right.
Me.
Everyone can get to that PDF of
Thanks
the New England
help.
Journal Review by going to our website, which will link you to Dr. Hollick's website, and then there's a PDF on that on his site. His site is www.vitamindhealth, all one word. .org. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. Our email address, line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk about vitamin D with authority Michael Hollick. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. And by the Alaska Wounded Veterans Project, a nonprofit organization that provides assistance to veterans who were wounded both physically and psychologically during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Information at alaskastateelks.org. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. Today, our guest is Dr. Michael Hollick. He's an expert on vitamin D. If you have questions, you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. Our local phone number, 550-8422, and our outside Anchorage number is 1-800-478-8255. Please remember, if you're listening at line one locally, but after 8 o'clock, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be taking phone calls or answering any emails. Dr. Hollick, here's another email that came in. It says, please address the relationship between vitamin D insufficiency and autoimmune disease. Is the relationship theoretical, or is there a good underpinning with scientific and epidemiologic studies supporting the relationship, and what are the possible mechanisms?
Sure. That's an excellent question. It's probably worth an hour's worth of discussion. But long story short is, that we know now that if you live above Atlanta, Georgia, for the first 10 years of your life, you have 100% increased risk of developing multiple sclerosis for the rest of your life. There was a nurse's health study out of Harvard where nurses that had the highest amount of vitamin D intake reduced their risk of multiple sclerosis by 42%. Women in Iowa taking the most vitamin D reduced their risk of getting rheumatoid arthritis by 44%. We know Crohn's disease is even associated with vitamin D deficiency. And as I had mentioned to you before, we're recognizing now that if you live in the Caribbean, you are 10 times less likely to get type 1 diabetes than if you live, say, in Finland or in Tierra del Fuego in the far southern part of South America. And so the latitudinal association is strong. We think that that latitudinal association is related to vitamin D because, like I said, the lower your vitamin D levels, higher is your risk for many autoimmune diseases. So why is there an association? We know that your immune cells, when they get activated, require vitamin D to function. And vitamin D plays a critical role in modulating the immune system. In fact, we now also recognize that it's very important for fighting TB and other infectious diseases, and may also be important in reducing risk of developing influenza, as well as maybe limiting the infection once it occurs. So there's a variety of good epidemiologic data and data that suggests that the lower the vitamin D levels, higher is your risk for autoimmune diseases. And the mechanism is clear. Immune cells need vitamin D to maximally function, to modulate their function, to prevent them from going awry and attacking your own body, which is basically what an autoimmune disease is. And if you have a foreign body coming in, like an infectious disease, then your cells, like what are called the macrophages, these cells that gobble up infective agents, get activate vitamin D, all for the purpose of helping the cell to kill the infectious agent.
Okay. Another question about vitamin D, and this is one you've kind of hinted at some of the answers already. Has there been any studies looking at whether menopause is a risk factor or an exacerbating factor for vitamin D insufficiency?
We showed that osteoporotic women that were seeing their doctor and put on an expensive osteoporotic medication, that 52% had inadequate vitamin D levels. And the reason, of course, is that essentially nobody is getting enough vitamin D. You might be, you know, your listeners might be saying that this guy Hollick is kind of nuts, right? I mean, you've all been taught that 100 units in a glass of milk or 400 units in a multivitamin is all that you need. We think that we probably have been off by a factor of 10 for the total amount of vitamin D required. And I'll give you a little bit of insight into this. Our hunter-gatherer forefathers, when they were outside all the time, were probably making on average 5 to 10,000 units of vitamin D a day. Our body adapted to that need. A good example is that if you think about this, as I had mentioned before, human breast milk essentially has no vitamin D in it. Now, that doesn't make any sense evolutionarily. Mm-hmm. And so it must mean that women, lactating women, are not getting enough vitamin D, like their hunter-gatherer forefathers. So a study has been done by Dr. Hollis in South Carolina, and he increased the vitamin D intake, and he found that you had to give a lactating woman between 4,000 and 6,000 units of vitamin D a day for her to satisfy her requirement and to put enough vitamin D into her milk to satisfy her infant's requirement. And so we now realize that probably humans require at least 2,000, probably up to 3,000 units a day for maximum health.
What are the best supplements if you want to recommend some, and particularly thinking about cost, are there inexpensive ways to get these supplements?
Yeah, I mean, what I do is I go to my local drugstore and I look for a 2-for-1 sale, and as long as it's a reputable national brand, you know, whether it's a local pharmacy brand, you know, or a national pharmacy brand, or a nature food type of brand, they cost probably about $6 to $8 for 1,000 unit tablets. There's a very nice product on the market that that I've started giving to some of my patients who don't like taking pills and tablets or for young children. It's called Wellesse, W-E-L-L-E-S-S-E. And it's a flavored drink that has about 1,000 international units in a teaspoon. It's a flavored effervescent liquid that you can put into milk or orange juice, or you can just take as it is. Very easy to take. Like I said, you can get the pharmaceutical form. The reason that I recommend that for many of my patients is that they won't remember to take a supplement every day, but if I give them a prescription, they will remember to fill it. And often the insurance company will help to pay for it. And so that's a nice way for them not only to treat their D deficiency, but to maintain their vitamin D. So there's a variety of ways of getting it. And, you know, I certainly don't disregard your diet. I mean, it is very important, for, especially for children and young adults, to increase their milk consumption. It's a great source of calcium, as well as has a little bit of vitamin D. Orange juice is now fortified with calcium, a superb source of calcium, and it also has a little bit of vitamin D. And like I said, wild-caught salmon has about 3 to 4 times more vitamin D than farm salmon, and I think in Alaska you appreciate eating wild-caught salmon. And, you know, even oily fish like herring and mackerel are other good sources. There's about 500 to 1,000 units in a serving. So as you can see, you can get some vitamin D from your diet, but you can't satisfy your requirement. You need to take a supplement. And or in the spring, summer, and fall, take advantage of the beneficial effect of the sun.
Let's be very clear here. What would your typical recommendation be for infants through the end of life, for individuals living in Alaska? We'll just, Alaska's a big state, but let's just use Alaska. What would your recommendations be for daily vitamin D intake, particularly the supplementation?
Yep. So what I would recommend, and that's what's going to be in my book, is that all infants up to the first year of life should be on at least 400 units of vitamin D a day, and preferably 1,000 units a day, and up to 2,000 units of vitamin D is perfectly safe. For children 1 to about 12 years of age, I recommend that they be on at least 400, and 1,000 is much better, and up to 5,000 units is perfectly safe. Teenagers, I believe, should be on 2,000 units of vitamin D a day. Up to 10,000 units of vitamin D is perfectly safe. And for all adults, again, 2,000 units of vitamin D a day from all sources, and up to 10,000 units a day is safe.
Okay. There's been someone emailed and wants to know to repeat the figures discussing in your reference to dosing on whether you're referring to vitamin D2 or D3. The listener thinks there may be some confusion. You want to clarify that issue again?
Sure. There's actually a lot of confusion about the D2 and D3 story, and I thought it might be worthwhile to explain it in a little bit more detail. Vitamin D2 comes from yeast. It was used back in the 1930s and successfully for 50 years in preventing rickets in children. And vitamin D3 comes from lanolin from sheep. Once they started making it cheaply, they were able to displace the vitamin D2. It's been suggested that vitamin D2 is less effective than vitamin D3. It's been suggested that vitamin D2 is less absorbable than vitamin D3. In my opinion, based on our work and other work, it's clear that vitamin D2 is as effective as vitamin D3 in maintaining your vitamin D status. You can absorb it equally well. And so there's no difference between vitamin D2 or vitamin D3. The other mistake that some doctors make is that they think that vitamin D2 has to get converted to vitamin D3. And so when they're getting their laboratory result back from a laboratory that separates the two, they get very confused. The two are different. And all you care about when you get your lab result is to add the two up and look at the total.
Okay. All right. Here's a what I think is a rather intriguing question, and see if you have the answer to this one. My internist has a patient. This is a woman calling that has breast cancer. Has her vitamin D level up around 40, and he seems to be pleased. I'm taking 2,400 international units per day, and she has breast cancer. I've heard that breast cancer patients should have a higher level. Would you comment on that, and what might be the target if you think it should be higher?
Yeah, I think that 40 is perfectly fine. In my opinion, there is no evidence that raising it to 50 or 60 is going to make that much difference. I think that the 40 level is perfectly fine, and I have a lot of my cancer patients just at about that level, between 40 and 60. So anywhere in that range, up to 100, is perfectly fine.
What about vitamin D and depression?
There is evidence that vitamin D is associated with increased risk of schizophrenia, depression, and Alzheimer's disease. And one of the reasons probably is that your brain has a vitamin D receptor, and your brain activates vitamin D. And we think that the brain needs vitamin D to be healthy and to maintain its mental function.
Another phone call. Tim, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Tim, you still with us? All right. Let's take another one. We'll go to line eight. Diane, you're on line one.
Hi. You touched on part of a question that I have about the difference between vitamin D2 and 3, and you went over in the beginning very fast about why cod liver oil is, you can't really take very much of that because of the vitamin A toxicity, but apparently, and you can set me straight here, when you take vitamin D2, you have to take a lot more of it. So when, and all the figures you're throwing out, you're really mostly referring to vitamin D3 dosages. Is that correct?
It is not correct. It turns out that they're equally as effective. We showed last year in healthy adults, they got 1,000 units of vitamin D2 or 1,000 units of vitamin D3. And to leave no stone unturned, we gave some adults 500 units of vitamin D2 plus 500 units of vitamin D3 together. They all raised their blood levels exactly the same. It's a misconception out there that we're desperately trying to put to rest. There is absolutely no difference in vitamin D2 versus vitamin D3.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Another email question says, if my body makes vitamin D in sunlight, will the light from sad lights also help me make vitamin D?
And the answer is no, because the sad light is high-intensity visible light, and the role of it is to suppress your melatonin levels so that you want to wake up and feel good in the morning. Most people who have seasonal affective disorder is because the low intensity of light is unable to suppress your melatonin level. And melatonin, as you know, puts you to sleep and makes you hibernate. So you get up in the morning, your melatonin levels are high, so you just really want to go back to sleep and hibernate, but you got to go to work. And so that's why people get depressed. And that's why bright light works, but it will not make any vitamin D.
Okay, it's the UVB rays, the same one that give us sunburns, that makes the vitamin D in our skin. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Another call or another email, actually. He's a 55-year-old postmenopausal female with an incidental finding of a kidney stone via a CAT scan. So it's an incidental finding. I've been taking 2,000 international units daily, and our vitamin D level is 49 nanograms per ml. Should I be taking supplemental vitamin D with the known kidney stone? Thank you.
Yeah, in my opinion, yes. In my opinion, there is no increased risk of developing a kidney stone by maintaining your vitamin D levels at where you're at. What we do know, however, is that if you have a history of kidney stones, what I do recommend is that you switch your calcium to calcium citrate, because the citrate will basically, what's called chelation, it'll hold on to the calcium and prevent you from developing kidney stones. So it's something that your listener may want to think about. Also, most kidney stone formers, it's due to hyperabsorption of oxalate, which is a compound typically in green leafy vegetables, especially spinach. And if you take your calcium with your meal, the calcium binds it and prevents it from getting absorbed. And so that's why we always tell our patients to take your calcium with your meals. And if you have kidney stones, take it in the form of calcium citrate, not carbonate.
This question comes from a discussion I recently had with a colleague here who's an endocrinologist. And I want to, in this program in particular, like to promote skepticism and looking for evidence. And he brings up a point which I think you've addressed to some degree, but I think it's very important for listeners to be thinking about. It says, do we have, he wanted to know, prospective studies demonstrated benefit from vitamin D on any disease? And you've mentioned the Finland study, but how much do we know about these really good prospective, particularly double-blind kinds of studies?
Sure. I mean, everybody always asks the same question. I'll give you a couple of examples. There was a study done in Omaha, Nebraska, and they were giving women 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day and 1,100 international units of vitamin D a day, and followed them for 5 years. After 4 years on 1,100 units of vitamin D a day with calcium, reduced their risk of all cancers by 60%.
Okay.
And there are data coming out showing in Germany that if you increase your vitamin D intake, you reduce your blood pressure. So there are more and more studies being done to demonstrate its benefits. But if you think about colon and prostate, breast cancer, these things take a long time to develop. Mm-hmm. And so to do a prospective study, you would have to do it for probably about 10 years. And the vitamin D story has not been out that long. And so as a result, we don't have the kind of well-designed prospective studies that I'm sure that he would like to see and I would like to see. But there's a mountain of evidence coming from all directions, from epidemiologic studies, retrospective studies, and even one study in Canada, which was remarkable to me, is that Julian Knight interviewed women that had breast cancer and asked the question, how much sun exposure did you have as a teenager and young adult? And then called twice as many women that didn't have breast cancer. It turned out that those women that had the most sun exposure as a teenager and young adult reduced their risk of getting breast cancer by more than 50%. And that's consistent with that nurse's health study I told you about, where nurses that had the highest blood level of 25-hydroxyvitamin D, on average 48 nanograms per ml, had a 50% reduced risk of getting breast cancer.
We haven't also fleshed out the idea that we're really increasingly not being exposed to much sunlight because we're not outside, we're wearing clothing, we're putting on sunscreens, we're being told not to be out in the sun so much. So there's a lot of reasons why our sun exposure may be a factor in decreased vitamin D levels as well.
There's a study that was actually done looking at that. We know that our population is becoming more vitamin D deficient. In fact, they're 20% more deficient now than they were 10 years ago. Why? Three reasons. One, increased rise of obesity. It turns out that obese people need 2 to 3 times more vitamin D than what I've recommended because the body fat holds on to the vitamin D and it doesn't let it go. And so they need 2 to 3 times more vitamin D. The second reason is that decrease in milk consumption, which is the only major fortified food with vitamin D, along with now fortified orange juice. And the third is increased sun protection.
Okay. It's a little bit more of a technical question. What's the difference between cholecalciferol and ergocalciferol?
Yeah, so cholecalciferol is vitamin D3, and ergocalciferol is vitamin D2.
Okay. All right. And remind our listeners again, if you're listening and have questions or comments, you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. Our local number, 550-8422, and our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. We've got about 10 more minutes while we're on the program in which we can try to answer your calls and emails. Let's take a phone call. We have a listener, David. You're on line one. What can we do for you? David, you still with us? His question looked like it was about sun lamps, so I think your previous answer about the sad lights probably answered that one.
No, actually, it doesn't.
Okay.
It turns out that there's only one lamp that you can actually go on the internet and buy. It's called the Spurdy lamp. It's basically grandfathered by the FDA. It's been produced since the 1940s. And so you could go as a parent to your local drugstore and buy this lamp, and you'd bring it home and expose your children to it to prevent them from getting rickets. We know that this works for, say, children and adults with cystic fibrosis that can't absorb vitamin D, or patients with Crohn's disease that can't absorb vitamin D from oral supplements or from diet. Also, believe it or not, and I make it very clear in my book, I do not advocate tanning, but a tanning salon that has fluorescent tubes will put out simulated sunlight and it makes vitamin D. And we showed that tanners in Boston had robust, healthy levels at the end of the winter, 48 nanograms per ml on average, compared to non-tanners, matched for sex and age, that had on average about 18 nanograms per ml. I don't advocate people going to Tanabed, but if they do want to go for their vitamin D, what I tell them is sun protection on your face, sunscreen, because that's the most sun-damaged area. But you can go in for 25 or 50% of the time recommended for tanning in a bathing suit. You'll make all the vitamin D that you need, especially if you can't get it from dietary or you're unable to absorb it from pharmaceutical or supplemental sources.
You've made some very important points to me as a pediatrician regarding breastfeeding, and I was very well aware of the current recommendations from the Academy of Pediatrics to give 400 international units to breastfeeding mothers. But another question that comes up is, in my mind, is what about pregnant women? What do we know about them and the effects of low levels?
Excellent question. So three things we now recognize, and it was work that we've done in collaboration with our colleagues at our hospital and also with Lisa Bodner in Pennsylvania. The first is that if women are vitamin D deficient, they have a much higher risk of having preeclampsia, one of the most serious complications of pregnancy. The second is we've shown in over 400 women having a C-section that they had a 400% higher risk of having to have a C-section if they were vitamin D deficient at the time that they gave birth. And finally, our neonatologists thought originally that women that were taking a prenatal vitamin, right, taking their vitamin D supplement and drinking a couple of glasses of milk a day, they're getting like 600 units of vitamin D a day on average, would they be vitamin D deficient? We found at the time that they gave birth, 76% of moms and 81% of newborns were vitamin D deficient. Why should you care? Because now the neonate in utero has been deficient in vitamin D, and maybe for the first couple of days of life, they may never attain their peak bone mineral density or their peak height.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the same thing said, and maybe it's in relation to this with teenagers. If teenagers don't get through adolescence with adequate bone stores or adequate bone density and so forth, that you really almost can't make that up.
Right. So 50% of the calcium that is in your skeleton for the rest of your life occurs during your teenage years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the Institute of Medicine, and I was on that committee back in 1995, recommended that all teenagers get 1,300 milligrams of calcium a day. Because Connie Weaver and others have shown if you continue to increase your calcium intake in teenagers, they will continue to put it into their skeleton. And they will maximize their skeletal health by being on 1,300 milligrams of calcium a day. So to give some perspective, that's about 3 to 4 glasses of skim milk a day. Every glass of skim milk or vitamin D and calcium-fortified orange juice contains 300 milligrams of calcium and 100 units of vitamin D.
Another, to me, rather important question to ask in this whole issue, which is begins to sound like we need to take more and more and more, is the issue of risks of too much vitamin, in particular vitamin D, particularly in the face of some recent studies suggesting increased over-supplementation with folate, and I can't remember what the other vitamin was, might be associated with the increased risk of cancer. Can you put this in perspective for us?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I can understand why, you know, people are skeptical, and in fact, you know, it's kind of like the vitamin of the year, and certainly it was, you know, vitamin E and many of these other vitamins. Vitamin D, I think, has sustainability because every tissue and cell in your body has a vitamin D receptor. Why are they there? Because they need vitamin D to maximize all cellular function and all organ health. And so I'm convinced that this is going to be a vitamin with sustainability, and it's being recognized more and more as being incredibly important for both children and adults' health and welfare. In terms of toxicity, like I said, we know, because we did the study with Bob Haney in Omaha, Nebraska, if you give healthy adults 10,000 units a day for 5 months, there was no toxicity. So we're confident that at these levels that we're recommending, that they are very healthy and that they are not toxic, unless, as your caller in the beginning, worried about sarcoid. If they have a granulomatous disorder, then they have to limit their vitamin D intake, but they do need some, but they should maintain it, like I said, about 25 to 30 nanograms per ml. Everybody else, children and adults alike, should all be between 30 and 100 nanograms per ml, and it's 25 hydroxy vitamin D, not the active form.
Okay. Got about 2 minutes left, and one question. You've mentioned that taking the dose of 50,000 international units once every 2 weeks, you might put that in context again for this email, but could this be taken in smaller doses that they want to know, or is it better to take it once every 2 weeks?
It's an excellent question. It turns out vitamin D is very forgiving, and so, for example, the half-life of 25-hydroxy vitamin D is 2 weeks. So you can take one pill a day. Or if you forget the one pill, you could take two the next day. If you forget it for a week, you could take seven for the week. So it doesn't really make any difference whether you take it daily, weekly, twice a month, or once a month. As long as the total amount is about the same, equivalent to 2,000 to 3,000 units of vitamin D a day, you're all set.
Last email here. Can you address whether or not vitamin D can impact mood? For example, we've talked about helping with depression. If so, is it related to a general improvement in well-being, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, well, first of all, like I said, people often have aches and pains of their bones and muscles, and that can make them not feel well. But we know, I see my patients all the time, within a couple of months of correcting their D deficiency, that their feeling of well-being is incredibly improved. They basically say that they've gotten back their lives, that their muscle strength is better, that they just have more energy, and that their mood is improved. So all of those seem to be beneficial by increasing your vitamin D intake.
All right. Well, I want to say thanks very much for taking the time out. There's a couple of callers I just don't think we have left. I don't think I'll have time to get to them, and a couple of emails just showed up. It's just too much to address. I want to make sure everybody realizes they can get to your website, Dr. Hollick, on our website at ksk.org/line1, and get to your website, which is, what is it, Vitamin D Health.
Health.org.
And I really appreciate
my book,
and it's called Vitamin D Solution, coming out in April. I very much appreciate your taking the time to share your expertise with us.
It was my pleasure, Thad.
Have a good day.
You too. Take care.
Next week, Line One's going to return, and we'll be talking with Brian Dunning, an author and podcast producer. He'll help us learn more about how to think clear about several healthcare issues. This promises to be a very enjoyable educational program. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. David Waldron engineered today's program. Have a good day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance,
or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.